Be helpful on this first morning to use the Dalai Lama's book, The Opening of the Wisdom Eye, to introduce the subject and give a general exposition of it. We commonly feel, or a good many of us feel, that the Mahayana is something so different from any of the other yanas. That is that tendency. And this book gives such a comprehensive view of Buddhism as a whole that we'll be able to appreciate just what where the distinctions do come in. The Dalai Lama opens his book with an interesting little account of the advancement of Buddhism in Tibet. He divides it into two sections, the ancient advancement and what he calls the later rather than the modern advancement. Now, this ancient advancement begins with about 650 AD of the Christian era. Well, it has to be that, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And he says the 32nd king of Tibet, Tsongtsen Ganpo, ascended the throne. He was deeply interested in Buddhism. He invited teachers from India, Kumara, Brahmana Shankara, Srila Manju of Nepal. These teachers translated the original teaching in the discourses and also the tantra, and within brackets we have texts for meditation practice. Although the Dharma was not taught widely, the king himself guided many fortunate people, especially in the teaching of the Mahakarunika, the greatly compassionate one, or Avalokiteshvara. Now here we have a slight difference from the usual Hinayana or Theravada presentation as such. After him there came the 37th ruler, Tritsong Datsen. I hope I'm pronouncing the Tibetan names not too badly. And he invited again teachers from India who went to Tibet. Shantarakshita and Padmasambhava. Now here we have, of course, one of the big names, Padmasambhava. This takes place in the latter part of the 8th century. There were many others also who were present, and they translated many works into Tibetan. The three main divisions of the Tripitaka, the sacred canon, the discipline, the discourses, and he uses a very interesting word, the psycho-philosophy, the Abhidharma, together with tantric teachings and many of the main commentaries were available in the Tibetan language. The next ruler, King Tritsong Detsen, the 41st in Tibetan history, his period is 817 to 836, also invited Indian Buddhist teachers to Tibet. Amongst them were Jinamitra, Surendra Bodhi, Dhanasila, and others. And there were also various translators, Jnanasena and Jayarakshita, to revise the old translations which had been done in the days of the previous kings. These pandits then prepared, with the permission of the king, an edition in 16 volumes of the work known as the Great Mother, in Sanskrit, the Shatasahasrika Prajnaparamita Sutra. That is the discourse in 100,000 verses upon perfect wisdom, or what we commonly call the Prajna Paramita. Then comes the later advancement. And here we make a jump of some centuries. Amongst these later teachers, there was the Mahapandita Shakya Shri from Kashmir, and with his work and activities, bhikshus again increased in numbers. Now I mention all this in order that we may appreciate the Indian influence as far as the uprising of the Mahayana was concerned. It's a very strong Indian influence, Nepal and northern India and northeastern India. Then there is a little description of the various Buddhist schools, which I think can just be summarized this way. They are divided again into the two groups, the ancient and the new. The ancient ones are called the Nyingmapa, and Padmasambhava, of course, is the great figure there. Then come the three others, which are the new. The first one is due to Marpa Lotsava. Lotsava simply means translator. Marpa was his name. Marpa Lotsava and his very great pupil, Milarepa, whose name you all know. And they were responsible for the introduction of what we call the Kajutpa or whispered transmission. Then comes the Mahasiddha, Vairupa, or his other name, Mahapandita Gayadhara. And he is responsible for the Sakyapa. Mahasiddha means the great accomplished one. Maha is great, Siddha is the accomplished one, the one possessed of perfections. And often this includes what we commonly call psychic powers and so forth. And the fourth one is, of course, Tsongkhapa, whose name we associate with the Gelugpa school. And the Gelugpa means the virtuous ones. Not that the others were not virtuous, but these are specially called the virtuous ones. Now, the Dalai Lama points out very clearly that the aims of all these schools is but one aim, namely the realization of Buddhahood. And the threefold training for all these schools is the same threefold training. That is to say, the training in Sila, in Samadhi, in Panya. He next deals with what is called dharma. Now the word dharma in the singular usually means the doctrine, the teaching, the law. It's derived from the word dhri, meaning to uphold. Dhri is the root, to uphold. This idea of upholding comes all the way back from the times of, from the time of the Rig Veda itself. The Rig Veda postulated the Ritta, which was the eternal law and order of all existence. And the upholding of this eternal law and order was dharma. So dharma applied to all orders of creation, be they gods, devas, humans, anybody. Everybody, every entity, whatsoever it was, had to fulfill its dharma, the upholding of the eternal law and order. We use the word religion, which is as good good an expression of the word dharma in that sense. But when we come to the plural word, dharmas, or in the Pali form, dhamma, then it has a specialized meaning. The dhamma refer to events of sensory or mental experience. These are the dharmas or the dhamma. the events of sensory and mental experience, in the plural. It's also used to mean mental states and so forth. But a mental state is an event of mental experience, is it not? So that is the meaning of Dhamma. And the investigation of the Dharmas is one of the very important aspects of the Mahayana. Next, he deals with Punarbhava. I'm just going to mention it in passing. Punarbhava, which is, of course, commonly translated as rebirth. But here is a very interesting note at the end of the book. Punarbhava means literally again becoming. This literal translation preserves the Buddhist emphasis upon dynamic and changing psychological states. A psychology which operates without reference to hypothetical static entities such as soul, atma, etc. Now the next sentence is very interesting. Reincarnation is a term quite foreign to Buddhist psychology, since it presupposes that which is to incarnate again. Even rebirth is only used for clarity of expression. One only finds jati, birth, mentioned in the texts. And jati also implies, its connotation is the conditioned state. Because as the Buddha teaches very clearly, whatsoever comes into being, that is jati, the coming into being is jati. Whatsoever comes into being is immediately in a conditioned state. It undergoes its process and it ceases to be. This word jati is not at all easy to translate into English. But I thought it would be interesting to read that note in connection with Punarbhava, which is treated extremely well in a short chapter in the book. He mentions also a particularly interesting point in this connection, namely that the mind continuum flows on. He first states, people have a view which is limited. When they see the dependence of mental continuity upon the physical body, they do not understand that the mind can also be independent of a gross physical base. As we read the words, we think we understand their deep significance and their full implications. But it would take years of deep meditation to understand just what the significance of that statement is, that mind can be independent of a gross physical base. I'm saying this just as a word of warning, that when we read this book, we mustn't try to fit our concepts into this which is presented here. And then on the next page, he mentions this point. It can be seen clearly that no knowledge arises without a previous cause, and that there is no cause for the arising and comprehending of knowledge which is external to one's own continuity, since only in one's own mental continuum can be stored the knowledge gained from one's own experience. Now, the next chapter deals with what he calls the two levels of truth. Paramartha Satya, absolute truth, and Samvriti Satya, relative, conventional, or empirical truth. Truth as we ordinarily experience it from day to day. Now this is an extremely difficult chapter. I had to read it about four times at least before I could proceed with my little review of this work for the Tibetan Review, which is published in Darjeeling. Extremely difficult chapter. I'm picking out just one little point, and that is in connection with what is called absolute truth. This is equated with nairatmya, not atma, no self and no soulness. Now note that, no soulness, nairatmya, in all things, in anything and in the person. And this is equated also with nisvabhavata. Nisvabhavata. Sva means self, bhavata, nature, and therefore ni is of course not self nature. Nisvabhavata. This is divided into the nairatmya, the no selfness of the person, as well as the no selfness, no ultimate entityness of dharmas, the events of sensory and mental experience. They are impermanence, in other words, is stressed. And then there's a very interesting little classification here, the four aspects of voidness. Bhava shunyata, meaning the voidness of that which is produced. Abhava shunyata, the voidness of the unproduced. Svabhava shunyata, the voidness of the self-produced. And parabhava shunyata, the voidness of the other produced. There is no explanation given of all these things here as such. It's a very difficult book to deal with. I just mention that because it is important as far as the understanding of Mahayana is concerned. Next he deals with the three pitaka, the three baskets, Vinaya, the Sutta, and the Abhidharma. Now, in this connection, I shall just read the last paragraph here. He gives the various reasons why the Sutra, Vinaya and Abhidharma collections were taught, and how they accord on various levels with destruction, that is, the destruction of the stains, the mental stains, grouped, as you know, under greed, hate, delusion. How they accord on various levels with destruction, training, and knowledge, thus illustrating the synthesis of skillful means and wisdom to be seen in the whole Buddhist teaching and in all three vehicles. The three vehicles presented are the vehicle of the disciples, the Shravakayana as it is called, of the Shravakas, of silent Buddhas, the Pratyeka in Sanskrit, the Pacheka Buddhas as put in Pali, and of the great vehicle, the Mahayana. Next he deals with the threefold training. Particularly from here onwards, the book is really a masterpiece. But it requires very careful study, and it does presume a considerable amount of background knowledge. here is a sentence which is interesting. While the essence of the training in supreme virtue is contained in the 10 refraining from unskill precepts, many other varieties of precepts could be described, but here 3 will suffice. The Pratimoksha precepts, the Bodhisattva precepts, and the Vajrayana precepts. All 3 groups of precepts are in fact included within the scope of these 3 classes. Now, most interesting of all is the presentation of the 10 refraining from unskilled precepts. You know how we have the usual 5 precepts in the Pali canon. Now, note the way in which they are presented in the Mahayana. You will see the agreements and slight differences too. The first one is presented as, of course, is the pranatipata, the panatipata precept, against killing. Only killing is mentioned here in this book. Now, killing is the most dramatic form of harmfulness. But the general precept, panatipana sikapadam veramani, is to refrain from all harmful action, whatsoever it may be, and not only in deed, but also in speech and in thought. Not to harm anything, any creature, anybody, in either thought, speech, or of course action. So there is a slight difference there. Then he goes on to refraining from taking what is not given, which of course is the same as the Pali presentation. And then he emphasizes the third, in the third precept, just the sexual aspect, refraining from wrong conduct in sexual desires. But the kamesu vichachara, I think, is better understood as presented in the Pali Canon. It is the refraining from all misuse of the senses, all the senses. Misuse of the senses. Put it another way, to refrain from all self-indulgence through the senses, through the medium of the senses. And this includes, remember, in all Indian teaching, what we commonly call the mind. The mind is the 6th sense. The discursive mind, the desirous mind. We think that our intellect functions purely as intellect. This is a gross misconception. If you were to look very clearly into all our ordinary intellectual functioning, you will find it is absolutely shot through and through with desire. Even the so-called great scientist, objectively observing, is observing desirously. Eddington, in his Tana lectures of 1936 in Cambridge, very clearly pointed this out. How difficult it is for any person's mind to be free of this desirous tendency which makes him choose this, that and the other in order to prove his preconceived idea. Now, this is very, very important. You see? Right. Then the refraining from wrong speech. And here you get the Pali canon and the Mahayana presentation in full agreement. Refraining from false speech, slanderous speech, harsh speech, foolish chatter. Now, I am just quoting my little summary of what the Buddha called foolish chatter as presented in the Pali canon. Actually, the term used in the Pali canon is low conversation. talk about kings, robbers, ministers of state, war, terrors, battles, foods, drinks, clothes, beds, garlands, perfumes, relatives and relationships, equipages, or is it equipages?
The mera equi will do.
Villages, towns, cities, countries, tales about women and heroes, gossip at street corners or wells, ghost stories, desultory talk, speculations about the land and sea, about becoming and not becoming, thus or thus.
Normal conversation. Normal conversation.
Now, what a marvelous hint, a gentle hint to the Buddhist to shut up forever. Ask the Buddha, don't ask me. And here is something very interesting on a slightly more serious note, and yet not quite so serious. The Dalai Lama presents it as follows, refraining from foolish chatter. Foolish chatter is of three sorts. First, untrue nonsense. Untrue nonsense, such as prayers to gods, legends, religious myths, and miraculous tales. Second, worldly nonsense, includes gossip, useless stories, English people particularly, please listen, fiction and jokes. Well, true nonsense, it's an extraordinary phrase, True nonsense, this is a very serious matter, is the teaching of Dharma to a person who is not yet ready to receive it.
Casting your pearls.
This is true nonsense, says the Dalai Lama. I mean, if that sinks into us, it would effect a revolution in our lives. This untrue nonsense, worldly nonsense, and true nonsense is the teaching of Dharma to a person who is not yet ready to receive it. How do we pick and choose? How do we know? You see the responsibility about teaching the Dharma. Now, let us go. Then we come to the difference in the Mahayana from the Pali Canon with regard to the Silas. The Pali Canon ends up with refraining from drinks and so on, intoxicating drinks. This goes on as follows. Refraining from covetousness, from ill will, from wrong views. So that is how the Mahayana presents the 10 silas as such. Then he has a few words about the Pratimoksha precepts. And then as regards the Vajrayana, there are too many to talk about, so he leaves all that alone. Next follows the section on the training in supreme collectedness, which is the training in samadhi. And he says, samadhi or collectedness may be analyzed into various levels of mental absorption, the dhyanas or the Pali jhanas. Collectedness is of two kinds, worldly and transcendental. Now this is a point we must specially note. Under what he calls the worldly forms of collectedness, he includes all the jhanas that we speak of in the Pali Canon. Then what is the transcendental jhana? the transcendental collectedness, transcendental samadhi. This consists briefly in seeing with wisdom, with right wisdom, the truths, anicca, dukkha, and anatta, with regard to every single thought, feeling, perception, action, event, and so forth. And at the very root of it all, to realize nairatmya. That is what is called the transcendental samadhi. I wonder whether we really can separate the two out so much. Is it possible to realize the deep samapattis, for instance, by themselves, separately from the transcendental aspect? It's very questionable. However, this is the conventional presentation, the orthodox presentation. Now, talking of these jhanas, there is a little passage here which I think should be interesting. In connection with the first jhana, or the first absorption, as you know, in the Pali Canon, they talk about the different aspects of it, the five factors composing it: thought conception, thought examination, joy, bliss, one-pointedness, the five factors. Then as you go through the deeper and deeper jhanas, one by one these factors fall off: thought conception and thought examination, then joy, then bliss, and then finally there is only the state of perfect equanimity. Ekagrata is translated as one-pointedness. Personally, I don't quite like the one-pointedness. It implies exclusive concentration. But if you practice entering into these deep states, does your attention become exclusive, or does it become inclusive? How does this state of ekagrata actually arise? It arises with the pacification, the subsiding, if you like, the pacification of the different sense consciousnesses which are continuously active in our ordinary state, even in our sleep state. As far as the swapna, the dream condition, is concerned, they are not inactive. They are present, they are active. It's only in the real sushupti that they become perfectly pacified. But one is unconscious then in sleep as such. Now, when in the awakened state, in the waking state, all these sense consciousnesses are pacified, not suppressed, not held under, but just pacified in a peaceful condition, each one of them no longer tries to obtrude itself upon your attention. Thereupon, one realizes the unified state, which to me seems to be the real meaning of ekagrata. It is the unified mind, wholly awake, completely attentive. But that attentiveness doesn't function in the way we are accustomed to experience attentiveness in our waking state, in our ordinary waking state. See, it's extremely difficult to talk about these things. I hope it has conveyed something anyway. So I would prefer to regard ekagrata not so much as one-pointedness, as the unified condition of the mind in which attentiveness is completely undistracted by the different sense consciousnesses. And in that sense, if you like, it is one-pointed. But not in the sense of exclusiveness. I think this is an important point. However, that is how it is usually translated. The Dalai Lama says, one should note that in the mental continuum of beings, there are both gross and subtle taints. Only the gross taints among these are destroyed by the absorptions, while the subtle ones are destroyed by the full development wisdom acquired at the time of knowing the noble paths. The Srotapana, and if you followed Dr. Werner's talk carefully last night, you could see the connection here. The Srotapana, then he who enters the stream, the seven times returner, the once returner, and the full arhat, the four. There are certain slight differences in the exposition of the four formless accomplishments, as they are called, the arupa samapattis. But we need not go into them now. And then he comes to the very important point which the Mahayana brings out again and again everywhere. And that is in connection with the wisdom development. The central point is to understand anatma, nairatmya. He says, I may as well emphasize again the teaching of no self-soul. It is upheld by all schools of Buddhist thought, since all alike recognize the Atman view, that is, adhering to belief in some permanent soul entity as the root of all trouble. I mentioned this in my talk the other night too. To suppose that things exist independently have a self nature, that things exist independently and have a self nature, is the Atman view, and this in turn is ignorance. It is because of this Atman view that beings are wandering on in the realms of birth and death. The Atman view is then the root of samsara, or the wandering on. And then he repeats here, no Atma has two aspects, the no Atma of the person and the no Atma of mental events, the events of sensory and mental experience, which is the no Atma of the dharmas. Now, the Atman view, whereby one conceives of an independent and self-existent entity called Atma or self-soul, veers towards eternalism, which means that one falls into an extreme view, that of eternalism belief. Perhaps a word here might be useful. We consider this business of the separate Atma, the independent entity Atma, and how the Upanishads called it not Atma, definitely. See? And of course, the Buddha confined, concentrated his attention upon this particular aspect because it led to so much misconception and consequently wrong action, unholy living in short. Very good. This Atman view, whereby one conceives of an independent and self-existent entity called Atma, it veers towards eternalism. You see, we as we are constituted are aware of our existence as a continuous, unbroken process. This is not true. We are so constituted that our sensitivity to the speed with which everything happens is not great enough to distinguish the individual aspect, the momentary aspect of it. You see, for example, science knows that energy goes out not in the fashion in which we see a river flowing. Energy goes out like this in packets. But the rate at which it happens is so tremendous that it seems to us to be an unbroken continuity. See? Now the same thing happens with mind. If you can see the living person who is visible to one's eyes as mind energy, I'm using the word energy in the ordinary scientific sense, as the final origin of the what we commonly call the material world. If you see this mind energy interlocked, flashing like that at an extraordinary speed, then you will realize that there is a void in between each flashing. From this void emerges creative renewal. Creation takes place here. This is the silence, the absolute silence referred to by the great mystics and the great religious teachers. This is the real transcendent nothing, where both mind and energy have their null point, so to say. In a sense, the null point which is not null. You see? Now, when we raise up a concept, Atma, because we are what we are, we conceive of this concept as just going perpetually through. And in that sense, eternalism is used, I believe. When theistic religions use the term eternal God, perhaps I may say they use the right words but have no conception of what they mean. Have you got it? See, this mind energy just goes flashing at an incredible speed, hundreds of thousands of millions of times a second, so to say. I mean, I'm just using a vast figure. And that null point is what we are not able to be conscious of. You may ask, how can you be conscious of that null point? You can't, of course. Because in that null point, what is a subject-object relationship has absolutely vanished. No such thing. And so, human beings conceive of an eternal entity in the sense of a continuing entity in time and space. Now do remember, neither energy nor mind have any relationship to the dimensions of space and time. Mind is not spatial, it's not temporal. Energy, pure and simple by itself, is neither spatial nor temporal. It is when energy, pure energy, manifests as protons, electrons, neutrons, neutrinos, and finally into our chemical atoms and all our gross collections of atoms which we call the objects of the world. It is only then that, as perceived by us as we are, by us ourselves as we are constituted, there arise the categories of the dimensions of space and the dimension of time. I have a suspicion that when God said, "Let there be light," and there was light, He plunged us all into darkness. Because that speed of light is that fundamental unvarying quantity from which originates all measurement. See, the Greek Uranos, the Rigvedic Varuna, is the measurer. He represents the measurer. And it is the measurer who always manufactures the universe. You'll find this in all the great religious traditions. You look into the Zohar of the Jewish people, perhaps the profoundest mystical treatise attributed, Professor Sholem is right, Moses de Leon. It's a post-Christian work, you see. And here, it is shown, that the first statement in the Bible is grossly mistranslated. In the beginning, God made the heaven and the earth. The words are Bereshit bara Elohim. Bereshit, in the origin, out of the unknown origin. Bara is the past participle, which means got created. We may, to put it into idiomatic English, we may say there emerged, out of the unknown origin, there emerged Elohim, the creative powers which gave rise to heaven and earth. Heaven and earth. Heaven represents what? The unseen, the unknown, the unconscious, if you like. And earth is this here that you and I experience as such. See? And then it proceeds, the Elohim said, "Let there be light." There is no mention of anything like Yahweh until the second chapter. The first chapter, there are only the Elohim. You see? And this business of in the beginning, it's a hopelessly misleading translation, because we immediately get the concept of time, which is a much later thing. In that point of origin. Now in the Zohar, you find the presentation corresponding remarkably to the other religious traditions. The Brahman of the Upanishads is the Ein Sof of the Jews. What the great Christian mystics called the the dark desert of the Godhead, the abyss, and they use such phrases, you see. Dionysius the Areopagite uses most extraordinary phrases for all this. Now, this point of origin of manifestation starts not with the Ein Sof, but it's, the Ein Sof is afterwards divided into the 10 emanations, as they are called. You have the crown of Kether at the top, then you have Chochmah, wisdom, Bina, intelligence. And it is this Bina, intelligence, the utilizer of wisdom, the precipitator of wisdom into the forms of existence, which is the point of origin in the unknown origin. And out of that, there emerged the Elohim, the creative powers. I see one of the very profound implications of all these ancient teachings is that the mind, our minds, are the link between that transcendent and this here. And when the mind has come to its luminous state, then at last something happens, so to say, and we try to put it, give some sort of verbal formulation to it. But this verbal formulation inevitably misleads, simply because the mind of me who reads this verbal formulation is still a clouded mind. There are clouds inside it, and therefore I don't see the light, or I see it distorted. But as and when these clouds disappear, one begins to see just what the true thing is. In that state, one can also realize this incredible swiftness with which mind energy pulsates. And the pulsating, as far as its apparent aspect is concerned, is the universe we experience. The null points in between are eternal God, if you like, call it what you like, Brahman, the absolute. The mysterious creative power which no one knows, no one can talk about, which is totally beyond everything. Now you see, that is what those old people meant by Atma and Brahman and so forth. And the Buddha, with enlightenment, saw how impossible to talk about this. So you see, I come under the category of the untrue nonsense people. Not the true nonsense people, which God knows what I'm saying. I hope you do. So, when God said, let there be light, and there was light, once the measurement business stepped in, the limitation stepped in. As you know, apart from E.A. Mill of Cambridge, who still holds the conception of the universe as a three-dimensional geometrical space, which is absolutely endless and at right angles to each other. But all the other great scientists, I think, have quite different views. And the generally accepted view is that light, which is for all ordinary purposes, which travels in straight lines, does nothing of the sort. It just goes round and comes back upon itself, signifying limitation, bondage, light itself. Light is responsible for our darkness, in a sense. It's all very absolutely astonishing, isn't it? But there we are. I'm sorry, I digressed rather a lot from Mahayana as such. So now, veers towards eternalism. I hope, however, that it has helped in some way to give a feel of what eternalism really means in Buddhist teaching. this perpetuation through space-time. Energy itself, mind itself are completely free of any such categories as space-time. It is only when this reality which is sensed by us constituted as we are, that it is ill-sensed. This is one of the profound, it is the ontological dukkha. The divine sorrow, if you like.
It's a convenient moment to please ask. When you get to one.
Oh.
Till tomorrow.
I say yes, we'll have to break out. Dhamma and Paticca Samuppada. Let me see what this is. Page 75. Yes, towards the end of this chapter, he talks about dependent arising in terms of the void. When one perceives dependent arising as the void, and the void as dependent arising, then with insight one perceives the essence of all Lord Buddha's discourses. Here we have, of course, a certain difference from the Pali presentation, which, of course, just enumerates the 12 Nidanas and discourses upon them as such. But if you take that and this, and, of course, meditate deeply upon it, then we can see, as I mentioned on Sunday night, that the Paticca Samuppada presents the mechanism of samsara. It is the rationale of dukkha. That is why it becomes so important really to understand this Paticca Samuppada. Once the rationale of it is really seen, its grip upon you falls off. As long as this body, this psychophysical organism remains alive, it will necessarily function only within the limitations of that Paticca Samuppada. But its imprisoning hold upon you is gone. Therefore, there is liberation. Perhaps we'll stop there today. I intended to finish all this tonight.